consider rule-based global governance and international institutions? A rule that looms large is the veto held by the P5. And we've already heard from Zachary some of the outlier behaviour of some members of the P5 with regard to the ICJ. 5 years ago, I published an article that asked whether the veto was a tool for deadlock or restraint. And at the time, the Security Council was in a stalemate over authorising military action in response to crises in Syria, Crimea, and Gaza. But despite that deadlock, I was, in that article, on balance optimistic that the veto could be perceived as a neutral tool that can be managed on a case-by-case basis in a way that progress could be made by linking its use or non-use with the Security Council's contribution to peace and security. I said that the veto could be compatible with the project of making the Security Council more accountable. Well, 5 years later, and we still have deadlock on those three situations mentioned, but we've also had political developments in the Security Council itself, and more importantly, in the governments of influential nations, and I am less optimistic. In the first panel this morning, we talked about positions that could be reversible. And thinking about my position on this, I think I'm ready to reverse it, and I'll explain why. So first, I'm going to set out recent trends in the use of the veto. Then I'm going to consider whether there's any legal obligation on the Security Council to act, and whether there is any accountability at the level of the Council or individual member states. And finally, I'll address future prospects of various reform proposals. So, thinking about the use of the veto in recent years, before getting into the statistics, as many of you know, having been on the Security Council or advised your governments in respect of it, the veto is not just the public negative vote in the chambers of the Security Council. We also have to take into account the threatened use of the veto, also called the pocket veto, which is hidden from the statistics and has a very real impact on the ability of the Security Council to act. The pocket veto may enable a member of the P5 to keep an issue off the Council agenda altogether, or if there is a written text already for a resolution, it can be used to soften the language or even completely undermine it. Famously, France used its pocket veto to prevent a resolution that would have expressly authorised military force against Iraq. The US, the UK and Spain had planned to present this to the Council in early 2003, and we know the fallout from that. And just last week, the US used the threat of the veto to water down Resolution 2467 on sexual violence in armed conflict. This resolution was ultimately passed 13 votes in favour, with China and Russia abstaining. But it was a different text from that which had been drafted by Germany, which is president of the Council at the moment. Germany had drafted a text that sought to establish a formal working group on sexual violence in armed conflict, to set up a mechanism to bring to justice those found responsible, and to develop victims' protection by giving formal recognition to their sexual and reproductive rights. China, Russia, and the US opposed having any kind of mechanism for justice. They also demanded that the working group idea be scrapped. And it was the US that threatened to use its veto if there was any language in the text that spoke of reproductive rights. And this wasn't because of its philosophy in terms of how sexual violence in armed conflict should be addressed, but because of domestic politics on a woman's right to choose to have an abortion, which is obviously a volatile issue in the United States. After the vote, the UK delegate stated, "We deeply regret the change to the language on services for survivors of sexual violence, and we recognise the acute need for those services to include comprehensive, reproductive and separate sexual health care." And France stated, "We deplore that the veto threats were brandished by permanent members of the Council to challenge 25 years of gains in favour of women's rights in situations of armed conflict." So it doesn't even have to get to the point of a negative vote for there to be real repercussions for the action or inaction of the Security Council. Now, we all know Article 27 of the Charter doesn't actually say the word veto. Instead, it says that decisions of the Security Council on all other, meaning non-procedural, matters shall be by affirmative vote of 9 members, including the concurring votes of the permanent members. Since 1946, the non-concurring vote, or veto, has been exercised by the P5 over 200 times, but in an uneven way. France and the UK have not cast a veto for 3 decades. The last veto was on 23rd December 1989, where with the US they joined in vetoing a resolution condemning the US invasion of Panama. China historically used the veto the least among the P5, but it's become increasingly active on this front and has cast 12 of its 15 vetoes since 1997. And I think this is consistent with what we heard in the second panel about the changing attitude and increasing engagement of China. Russia has cast about 25 vetoes since 1997, and the US has used it about 17 times since the end of the Cold War. The most recent veto, express veto, was at the end of February this year, when a resolution was tabled on Venezuela calling, among other things, for free and fair elections. China and Russia exercised their vetoes, stating that this resolution was written to instigate regime change on a pretext of caring about people. We have seen all of this before in Libya, Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. And if we look at the issues that attract the express veto just in the last 5 years, we can also see kind of an increasing tension and rejection by certain members of the P5. So the situation in the Middle East has led to vetoes, the US on Palestine, and Russia and China on anything to do with action in Syria. Russia has also vetoed 3 other resolutions in the last 5 years, one on sanctions regarding Yemen, another one on setting up a tribunal to investigate and prosecute those responsible for the downing of flight MH17, and I think most shockingly, vetoing a resolution on the 20th anniversary of the Srebrenica genocide. So a key component of rule-based global governance is accountability, and we've heard about legal accountability in the context of the ICJ. When we talk about accountability in the Security Council, I think we're talking about requiring the Security Council to act. And the action typically called for is the passing of robust resolutions in under Chapter 7 in the face of situations or disputes that threaten the peace. Accountability can also involve the Security Council holding back, reflecting, taking incremental steps. And when I wrote about this 5 years ago, I thought that this withholding of the veto may create an atmosphere of restraint. It might generate a more durable peace than the quick and rash authorization of military action under Chapter 7. Well, I step back partly from that position today because the stalemate that has been created by the veto in situations such as Syria has not been in the service of deeper reflection or a more durable peace. There are 3 potential sources of legal obligation on the Council to act in situations such as that in Syria, and they all have their weaknesses. If a situation could be said to be characterised as genocide, which is not the case in Syria, there is an obligation under the Genocide Convention, as interpreted by the ICJ in the 2007 Bosnia-Serbia judgment, that any state with the capacity to influence effectively the action of persons likely to commit or already committing genocide has that obligation to act. And that capacity to influence could indeed apply to the P5 in theory because of the strength of their political influence with the veto, and often they have political, economic, and other links to the states involved in the situation. And it could be said that a state under the obligation to prevent genocide could mean refraining from vetoing the authorization of military action to deal with the genocide. Of course, this is a very narrow obligation. It requires a certain level of knowledge, and it would only apply if the situation really did fulfill the specific genocidal intent which will be very, very few. The second potential source is responsibility to protect, which was a Canadian idea that then was watered down in the 2005 World Summit outcome document. And although it speaks of the Security Council taking timely and decisive action, it also speaks of that being done expressly on a case-by-case basis and as appropriate. So there is, in fact, no hard requirement on the Security Council or its members to put a matter on the agenda, to support a decision, or to have a good reason to use the veto under the auspices of R2P. And finally, we have the draft articles on the responsibility of international organisations, DARIO, drafted by the ILC in 2001, and certainly they are not considered to have a status as customary international law, unlike many articles, many of the articles on state responsibility. But it has been argued that Article 14 of DARIO could be relevant, which says that an international organisation is responsible if it is aiding the commission of an internationally wrongful act. But this would be a very tricky situation to prove. You would have to characterise a veto of a resolution as somehow forming aid and assistance to an unlawful act. And you would have to show that that member of the Security Council intended by that veto to facilitate the occurrence of the wrongful conduct. And I think the situations in which that would be possible to prove are highly doubtful. The second article of DARIO that's invoked is Article 42, which is equivalent to that in state responsibility, which is the obligation to cooperate to bring to an end by lawful means any serious breach of a jus cogens norm. So could we interpret the phrase shall cooperate to bring to an end as obliging the Council to pass relevant resolutions to maintain peace and security? That is also a stretch. The Council's ability to cooperate is not just up to one member, even a vetoing member. It has to take into account its procedure, its inbuilt balance of power, and of course it's only a duty of conduct, not result. Some people have argued that instead of looking at the accountability of the Council, we have to look at the accountability of individual members of the P5. And John Hayek, for example, has argued that Russia and China have breached their duty to prevent war crimes by exercising the veto repeatedly with regard to Syria. But is there a duty to prevent war crimes? Genocide, yes. But the Geneva Conventions say nothing about a duty to prevent war crimes. And even if there is a duty, what is the standard? How do you fulfill it? And how can you show a causation between the veto and violations on the ground? So if existing international law is not providing us with a solid basis for accountability, can that accountability be achieved through reform to the Security Council? And almost as soon as the Security Council was composed in 1945, there have been efforts to reform it. These fall into the categories of formal, informal, and forms of restraint. The formal avenues are hopeless. The UN Charter has been amended only once in respect of the Security Council, which was 55 years ago, and it was to increase the non-permanent members from 6 to 10. Formal amendment to alter the use of the veto would be impossible. Article 108 of the Charter requires two-thirds of the General Assembly to agree, and then ratification by two-thirds of the member states and all members of the P5. It would probably be easier to dissolve the United Nations itself than to amend the veto power under the Charter procedure. So then we turn to informal change. And there's certainly ways that you can influence the procedure in the Council. The Council's powers have expanded through informal means. It's created peacekeeping from scratch. It's created ad hoc criminal tribunals. It's had reforms of its working methods and procedures that have led to some more openness and involvement of groups of friends. So there have been efforts on the informal level. The group calling themselves the Small Five, Costa Rica, Jordan, Liechtenstein, Singapore, and Switzerland, proposed in 2005 that the P5 should pledge themselves to refrain from the use of the veto in cases of genocide, and large-scale human rights abuses. The S5 disbanded 7 years later, but their idea of this kind of pledge of restraint was taken up by another group of states who called themselves Accountability, Coherence and Transparency, or ACT, and there were 27 states, and they developed a code of conduct that urges the permanent members to agree to refrain from using their veto in situations involving mass atrocity crimes. And as of this moment, there are 119 member states that have signed that code of conduct, but the only P5 members that have signed up are the UK and France. Russia, China, and the United States have rejected the code of conduct. And in any event, even if they had signed up, there is a savings clause in the code of conduct that says this would not apply to any cases where the vital national interests of a P5 member are at stake, which would render it inapplicable in a self-judging manner to many situations. So, in recent times, the veto has become a tool of political deadlock, not restraint. It does have a potential to prevent a rush to action and to provide a space for discussion and reflection, but that has been severely limited in the way it's being wielded by Russia, China, and occasionally the US. It is being used to advance self-interest, to protect perpetrators of atrocities unfolding in real time, and to water down Security Council action purely for domestic political gain. Multilateral solutions do exist and have been creatively suggested by various groups of states, but they ultimately require individual countries, right, US, Russia, and China, for them to be meaningful. Thank you.